Hello and welcome to The Spectator's Table Talk podcast, where we speak to guests about their life through food and drink. And we're delighted to be joined by Jeremy Lee, the chief proprietor of the landmark Soho restaurant Quo Vadis, and one of the leading and most joyful lights of British cooking. Jeremy, thank you for joining us.
Oh God, hello. Thank you very much for having me. It blushes deeply.
Let's start at the beginning. You were born in Dundee.
Yes, I was indeed.
To a mother who was a domestic science teacher.
Yes.
So tell us what food was like in your home growing up.
I lucked out. Obviously, being early 60s, there wasn't much good food around. I remember the courgette causing a great stir and, you know, as a commotion of glamour. You know, look what we've got, you know, went, oh God, it's a courgette. You know, my mother just thinking, really? But that was what it was like. And we ate very simple, good, plain Scots fare, like mince and tatties and sausage stews and skirly, which is a sort of delicious fried oat malarkey, mealy puddings. And I also had lunch at my grandmother's every day while I was at school. So much as I love my food, my father and my brothers remained painfully, annoyingly thin, and I ballooned like a veritable bunter. So there's obviously something from an early age between me and food. And then it was also at the time when awareness of French provincial cooking and cuisine bourgeois and bon femme and Elizabeth David was really coming into the fore. And mum, a great Francophile, just, you know, embraced this wholeheartedly. So we ate incredibly well, and there were still good shops around there, and you could still drive up a road, park outside a shop, go in and buy their ingredients, lovely things, bacon from Mr. Aikens or parmesan from Mr. Armatrudo or the butcher for really good beef. And we shopped like that, so everything was bought fresh every day, and we cooked at home. And there were no restaurants, so, and we were quite a boisterous family because we've got three siblings. So everything was around the table, you know, where we, you know, scoffed away like crazy on this food that we took utterly for granted and now miss terribly, being orphaned, which is a bloody awful business. But I hark back very happily to those days. It was really, it was delicious, bright and fresh. Even if it was just a plate of cold sliced ham and a little potato salad on the side, it was incredibly good. She had a very good knack, mum, of making food taste good and look good, but very artlessly and simply, which I think struck a chord and has remained with me ever since.
And did your mum teach you to cook?
Oh, God, no. We weren't allowed in mum's kitchen at all. But I did seek refuge at my mum's ankles a lot as my two older brothers sought to kind of dispatch me on a daily basis to restore themselves to being the only children of my parents. And so I spent a lot of time in mum's kitchen, and I would sort of while away the hours at a sketch pad or a notepad, doodling and drawing away and what have you. And, you know, and we'd grab a cookbook and read them now and again. But I didn't, the first thing, I baked in mum's kitchen. I do remember going trying to get an extraordinarily handsome, good housekeeping book. They had amazing pictures of rock cakes and scones and buns. There was stuff that one of the few things that did remain in Dundee that persevered is baking in Scotland as an extraordinary craft that seems somehow, you know, not as many as there once were, but still exist, and something we hold very, very dear up there. Because, frankly, you need your calories up there because it's bloody cold. I mean, you're brought up wearing shorts to the age of 12, you know, and if in the ice, you know, the ice cold winds blowing in off the east coast right the way down the tea estuary, you need a scone, and a lot of butter and a lot of jam, and cake to go with it too. So we ate very well. It was really good produce because Dundee was also very remote then. So we ate locally and, you know, what was good at the time. And, you know, that was the norm. And I think it was the norm for quite a lot of folk, actually, you know. And it wasn't until, you know, we had no supermarkets then. That's what something I sort of kind of hark back to being kind of weirdly strange. But shopping on the high street was the norm. There was not the days of pulling into a gargantuan Wembley-sized car park to go into a shop four times the size of Wembley was anathema. I wouldn't even know what that meant. Now it's the order of the day. But it was great fun. And I always remember there were sort of just boxes and bundles of little brown bags, paper bags wrapped up with things inside them. And when we got home, unwrapping all this was just great fun, and filling baskets and bowls and shelves with good things was just very lovely. And, you know, it's something I still cherish most about what I do, you know, because it's shopping is much more fun than prepping it.
And it doesn't sound like you were a fussy eater as a child. Was there anything you wouldn't eat?
Bad food. It was always hilarious.
It's a good policy.
I know. Oh, no, it was, you know, my parents were ferociously protective of their four children. I really got annoyed when you came home from school and said, I've been invited to a friend. A friend? Who is this friend? And I'm like, oh, well, you know, we're giving this third degree about who this person was. I'm like, you went to school with his mum. I mean, you know perfectly well who this kid is. I don't know what you're talking about. Or dad went to. And they said, oh, I said, but you'll eat badly. And I was like, and? What do you mean? Because we didn't know what bad food was. And inevitably, we always came back and said, mum, it was tin chopped fruit. And she said, I told you. And tinned custard on it as well. She said, yeah, you see? So these sort of strange messages came through right the way through and stuck. It was very, very funny. So I think food, I mean, beans on toast can be brilliant on a really horrible, sorry, Sunday night. But, you know, when it's lazily done, it's horrible. But when it's done with a tongue-in-cheek fun thing, it's just the best thing in the world. You know, and timing and lighting for places is great. But bad food, it's really rotten. It's not fun trying to scoff bad food. You're just like playing with it on the plate. Just not good.
You mentioned lunches at your grandmother's during school. I mean, did you have school food as well, or were you lucky enough to have your grandmother's food every day at school?
I avoided it completely. It's amazing. When folk talk about school food, I go, delicious. Well, it's absolutely amazing.
That's not the normal response we get on this podcast.
No, when you look at these grey pallid things, you know, and I mean, God knows how these strapping football playing types grew up. I was just like, how? You know, I just grew. My waist grew. My shoulders did not. It's very annoying. You know, it's very, very. But Granny was a great cook. She was one of these remarkable late Victorian women because she was born in 1899. And when she became a young woman, so during the First World War, for heaven's sakes, as a woman, it was her brothers that got the education. She didn't. She was very bad. I've got her cookery books and some of her notings. And this exquisite copperplate handwriting for wonderful recipes like seven-cup pudding and lentil soup and mince and tatties and good plain Scots fare like that. And, I mean, meticulously written down because she had to teach herself. She had to be educated herself because she was educated at home and teach herself how to cook when she became a wife. You know, so that was, you know, good housekeeping to the fore, which is still the great Bible, I think, for anyone. You know, if you want to know the basics, good housekeeping will hold your hand magnificently through all this and teach you how to use a cookery book more than anything else, which is very, very important. But she was amazing. And there was always a soup, and there was always a main course, and there was always a pudding. Always a pudding. Always with cream and always with custard. And sometimes cream, custard and ice cream, just to be sure. Just in case there was any doubt.
So you loved food and you were baking a bit, but essentially not learning the craft of cooking at home. How did you end up in a professional kitchen?
God, well, it's a strange old thing, because I think women back then, well, you know, the kitchen was their one little domain, piece of privacy. And because that's where they were bound, that was their thing. And we weren't encouraged in there, because that's where sort of mum and dad sat, because we had this big, it was quite a modern house we lived in. Actually, a very modern house we lived in. And there was a counter where mum and dad sat and had their, you know, smoked and drank their gins and tonic. Quite a lot. And we were not in there. So it was her domain and it was her role to provide. And so the thought of children coming in and mucking out it just didn't even occur. And the first thing I got to cook brilliantly was Maddy O'Jaffrey's brilliant BBC series, An Invitation to Indian Cooking, which blew the cobwebs away from everything. It was a BBC show, but, you know, it was the antithesis of Fanny Craddock and all this, you know, just gung-ho nonsense that was going on. But this exquisitely elegant, very gentle-handed woman, you know, gathered her spices together and put them on a plate like an artist would a palette, and then ground them and cooked them. And you could almost smell the food. I mean, it was the wobbly set, of course, you know, and all that stuff going on. But my God, and those recipes were. So I got the book and said, Mum, and she went, so I wasn't allowed to cook our home food, because that was that, but I could cook Indian food. And because Mum was born in India, you know, there's some little something from on high came through and went, that's all right. So I used to cook little, you know, curries and dishes and side dishes and chutneys and things, and, you know, and adored it. I thought it was amazing fun. And the only other thing I cooked was a moussaka. But what Dad clocked, which is quite interesting, was it was quite good. I actually tasted something and was accomplished, you know, and which is more to do with Maddy O'Jaffrey's recipes than anything else. I have to say, bravo, Maddy. And when I got into cooking professionally, sort of came about, it was our last family holiday together, all together, you know, because my brothers were quite grown up, and it was my fifth year at school, senior school, and it was not expected for me to pass my exams. I mean, really, I think they were underestimating my tamales. And in fact, they did, because I came back to this awful brown envelope, and you went, oh, God's sakes, you know, and some players, mum and dad, furiously unpacking 3 weeks of France and four kids and bedlam going on. And I opened this thing, and then, blow me, I had indeed passed my exams and went to mum and dad and said, does that mean I don't have to go back to school? And she went, no, darling, not if you don't want to. And I went, can I not go then? And she said, yeah, what are you going to do? And I said, well, can I go to commercial college? Because they had these colleges then, which was sort of a bridging gap between, you know. I mean, what on earth do you know at 15 or 16? And, I, you know, but I had a view to going to art college to study illustration, which is a my real love, I thought, at the time.
It's what your dad did.
And that's what dad did, and my grandpa did. You know, the whole family's very good with their hands. It's quite a nice thing. They're all good at making things and drawing and stuff. And to earn some pocket money through all this, because suddenly, what's really strange is your parents are shelling out all this money for your school fees. It doesn't translate to pocket money somehow. It's very annoying. So it's just like, you know, just give me that term in my pocket. No, it just doesn't work like that. So suddenly I'm footloose, fancy free and stone cold broke. And a young entrepreneurial couple from Edinburgh had just bought a very beautiful manor house down the road from where we lived that belonged to a friend of my mother's, who'd sadly recently died. And this amazing house came in the market that had been in private hands forever and belonged to every single extraordinary family that had ever been. So I had amazing plasterwork for the Wallace family and Buchans and Buchanans and all this mad crop round the Angus, the county of Angus and all up the East Coast. And they turned into this not half bad country house hotel, and they really wanted good food. And it was the days of prawn cocktail and salt salmon and fillet steak, peppered fillet steak and all that. I mean, all the trad, the, you know, cliches you could imagine. But they did do it really, really well. And I got a job as a waiter there. And this will show you the esteem in which chefs were held back then. I was such a rubbish waiter because I kept gossiping with everyone in the dining room because they were all friends of mum and dad's. And so I dropped this pot of red cabbage down my front once when I was gossiping too much. So bad. It was really embarrassing. And instead of sacking me, amazingly, for being rubbish, they put me in the kitchen.
You're demoted
to a commie chef.
And the rest is history.
And that, quite literally, and dad, and I was going, you know, felt like some little Oliver Twist going, dad, don't make me do it. It was like, back you go. So I was dispatched back to this bloody kitchen. You know, five doubles a week, thanks very much. Bye-bye childhood, bye-bye teen years, bye-bye, you know, rebel. What a joke. And ended up serving by complete happenstance an apprenticeship. And the chefs I worked with were old school, but they were young and enlightened, and they were very sweet to me and took me under their wing, kind of. And this great big round blob of a creature who was dressed in whites going, what am I doing? And, you know, carved away and chipped away until they moulded something of a cook and sent me to London to work with their old chef at Boodle's on St James's Street, that very grand club, where I didn't last very long. I think my days of that old school cooking had sort of come to its conclusion, and set off into the great sea of London. And there I was, you know, and as they say, it's history, I suppose. Here we are.
Here we are having a good old gossip
on a Friday afternoon about the whole thing.
And then you went to work with Simon, or under Simon Hopkinson at Vivendum.
Yes.
And how did that all come about?
Oh, golly. Well, I suppose, my entire teenage years were spent in a kitchen. And blessed, it wasn't a troglodyte basement job. It was a very beautiful, you know, ground floor of a manor house. I mean, it was, you know, you looked out on gorgeous lands. It was really ridiculously idyllic, as apprenticeships go. And it wasn't London hours. It was, you know, you started at 10 in the morning. So it was very sweet. But a great part of my youth went up in a puff of smoke. And so when I got to London and I was in my early 20s, I went, what a man, a bit of life, you know. And so a very dear friend of mine was working at a catering company at the time called Duff and Trotter, which sadly no more. But it was really great. It was one of the early really foodie ones. And though we loathe the foodie term, but, you know, it was prevalent at the time. In fact, I'm just born, in fact, if I'm not mistook. And I went to work with them as a cook, you know, nothing more. But over time, I became their head chef when I was a very tender age. And I liked catering. It was all right. But it was... It's very different in a catering kitchen to a restaurant kitchen. You know, there isn't the rhythm and the routine that gets you through all the stuff, and there isn't the obedience to seasonality as such, you know. I mean, it's all very different now, but back then it wasn't so. Delicious food, really, I mean, really scrumptious. And the food thing was beginning to really gather momentum and get steam under it. And one night we did a dinner for our great grandee. It's the height of the Thatcher years. This enormous pile in Holland Park. And I was like, oh, bloody hell, it's all a bit impressive. It's way out of my bag and reach. So anyway, down, you know, you got, I mean, that's typical with the English saying, you go through this immense house and there's this enormous hallway. And then you go down this rickety little staircase into this pooky little kitchen. You're like, oh, really? You know, and there's a Twisted Princess in the corner. And I'm like, what? And you know, there's all these tables laid out. And I've got a four burner on which to cook all this filet. I have no recall at all how I got through that dinner. All I remember is blood dripping off this cooker onto my shoes going, oh God, and it's not mine, is it? It's dinner. Anyhow, somehow we got through it. All I remember is going to work the next morning absolutely drained of any will to live, expecting the worst, and get summoned up to the office going, oh God, here it goes. And they said, well done. And I went, well done. I'm not used to that kind of language, thank you very much. Less of that talk. I'm an East Coast Presbyterian Protestant Scot, thanks, with a bit of wee free in there too, you know. We do guilt, not, you know, not patting on the back. And they said, no, we're really, really well, and they really enjoyed it, and they've given us £1,000 tip. Back then, which was a whopper. You could buy a car for that. Not like a drove, of course. And they said, as a big thank you, we're going to take you to any restaurant you want to go to for dinner. Big slap-up job. And what had just opened was Bibendum. And I said, you know, and I could have gone to Le Gavroche, but I wasn't. I have great admiration for the grand scale of the great cooks, but it wasn't what I wanted to cook. You know, and I like eating it now and again, but what I love is just, you know, that bourgeois cooking. And Terence was at the forefront of bringing that into restaurants and brilliantly got Simon Hopkinson to open Bibendum with him and equally partnered him as well. And sat down to this astonishing dinner and, you know, it was an epiphany. You know, everything changed. And so I went home and asked Dad, I said, you couldn't draw me a little something for a CV? And he went, yeah. So I got this mad portrait of me painted by Dad, this little black and white drawing, which I've got somewhere at home. And because I was far too shy to send it in myself, so I went through. There was a little catering company in Soho called Jubilee. And Jubilee sent Jeremy Lee to Bibendum for an interview. And I don't think we discussed anything about cooking. We just gossiped for 20 minutes. And I got a job. And so I gave up my exalted title of head chef of a catering company to become a cook in our chef de partie in Bibendum. That changed absolutely everything. You know, here I was suddenly in a kitchen with an extraordinary crew and this very enlightened chef and cooking everything that I'd read about and dreamt about and loved most. It was a Francophile, old French cooking, Elizabeth David, all this stuff. All the pieces fell into place and it was magical. And he's become a great friend, which is even better, you know. And so that's a relationship that's now stood the test of time for an awful long time now, you know, which is great. And I've just cooked him lunch as well, actually.
So what was it about Simon's cooking that drew you so quickly, so immediately?
I think it was the seemingly effortless exquisiteness of the flavours and the cooking and the ingredients all together on the plate. And nothing else. None of this awful G word, that thing called garnish, which I've never understood. Nothing was on the plate that shouldn't be, and it was accomplished and beautifully cooked. And when you put your knife and fork together, you'd eaten everything on the plate. And then it all worked, and it was humble. I mean, it was really brilliant. And if it was just a steak or a roast chicken or a lamb's brains, or I mean, whatever the dish was, it was astonishing. And it was beautifully balanced menus of offal and white meat and birds, and you know, it was really well balanced. And it was the first time I had gone to a restaurant and just seen, I want to eat all this. And when you did eat anyway, it was all delicious, which was very unusual in a restaurant, even then.
And do you think there's a kind of London style of food, or even a kind of British style of food, or is it just still quite a vague idea?
Oh, golly gee. Do you know what's so brilliant about that question, Lara, is I have no idea. And I think none of us do. And I think there's a constant squawk goes up. Why is it always so London-centric? And, well, I left Dundee to come to London when I was 21. And I'm not sure how different it is. I mean, obviously the world has changed. But I wonder if I could serve the food in a remote little pretty manor house just outside Dundee that I serve in Soho and be able to, because I still think there's an expectancy of food being an event and it needs to be, you know, all the garniture and prettiness and, you know, tweezers and whatever, which is not me. That's just, it's not that I dislike it in any form, but it's not my style of cooking. And that's one of the brilliant things that really has come out of the last 2 decades of this phenomenal revolution in restaurants and cooking. If we were all cooking the same thing, we'd be scuppered. We'd have gone like France when everyone was cooking very similar food. There are many, many, many voices. And what London offers is an extraordinary breadth. Not always great, for sure, but that's all of us, you know, because it's such a wild, crazy realm now that we live in. And restaurants open up at a spectacular rate. And we hear about all the glamour and fun of it, but there's a lot of very hard work and there's a lot of sad stories as well. But whether it's London-centric, you know, go to you eat in Edinburgh and Glasgow, you know, you need folk to fuel a restaurant business. And London has that crowd and enough of them to fuel a great many restaurants. And without that very fundamental existence, you know, then restaurants would seriously struggle because they are low down in the pecking order of necessity and luxury in life, you know, and that's what, you know, restaurants are becoming more and more a necessity as folk just want something to get away from it all and not face a great pile of washing up in the afterwards. It's worth the bill.
So after Bibendum, you were made head chef of the Blueprint Cafe, which was the Design Museum's restaurant.
Ah, but I went to Alistair Little in between.
Ah, sorry.
Yes.
Take us through that. We'll come back to the Design Museum. We've got plenty of time.
Oh, well, that's a great friend of mine saying, my dear, what did you do? Lifers get less than your term in the Blueprint. You know, it's a shocking business. While we, at that time, there was an extraordinary trinity of chefs, and one was Simon Hopkinson, the godfather was Roly Lee, and the other one was Alistair Little. And those three all bounced off each other fantastically. And if we weren't cooking in a restaurant at the time, we would be eating in one. And the one I ate in mostly was Alistair's on his eponymous restaurant on Fifth Street in Soho. And one night, absolutely blotter on martinis. Must have been working terribly hard. Tired. You know, as these things happen. I went stumbling into the kitchen and God knows what on earth Alistair thought. He was like, oh no, not that Dundonian, that noise is here again. And brilliantly gave me a job. And so I ended up cooking with him for, gosh, a long time, years and years. I met the most astonishing people there and fed astonishing people. And, you know, it was almighty. And that balance of the very big, you know, being the very birth and beginning of what was to become the modern British cooking and restaurants, which I still think is a weird term, because actually what the modern Brits were doing was actually discovering the roots of cooking in British food and its culture. And so it was a really fascinating time. And produce was beginning to appear, the like of which we hadn't ever seen. And stuff grown here, which was even more extraordinary. And so that balance with a lot of, you know, so this, you know, more and more, it became more and more defined by great regional cooking. And, you know, of course we borrowed holus bolus from Italy and France because, you know, on form it is the best. But we began more and more and more to apply things we learned from that cooking to British produce and cooking, and suddenly realised, yes, we are a series of states and counties and food and produce.
What do you think Alistair brought to British... I know we're not sure about the term, but to modern British cooking, what was it that he contributed most significantly?
No, I'd like to think it's a renaissance in awareness of food as well in the British Isles. But what Alistair and Simon and Roly did primarily, because when I was a kid starting out, it was very unusual for a middle-class kid privately educated to go into a restaurant. It was just not the norm. You know, we were bred to be lawyers and dentists and doctors and something academic, which does not suit everyone by any sense of the imagination. And we didn't know what terms like dyslexic and all that were at the time. And basically, I didn't suffer from that, but my brother did, you know. And so it was a very square time we grew up in. And when you went into restaurants, it was, I mean, the chefs I worked with were deeply puzzled by, you know, by a sort of privileged kid would come into this, you know, dead-end, horrible job, which they didn't give that impression as well, I have to say, but they were puzzled by this. And when I worked with Simon and then with Alistair, suddenly the thing I was the last piece in the puzzle, I think, to then start this great movement. And on Brain came in, an academic, a very fiercely intelligent, bright approach to food, that it should be delicious, it should be a joy, this can be a career, you can make a brilliant living out of this. And that's what they brought to the table in abundance. And that door, which had been very well bolted beforehand, suddenly got smashed in completely. And kids were saying, well, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to work in a bank, Dad. I don't want to be a dentist or a doctor or an architect. I want to use my hands. I want to create things. I want to make things. And it suited a lot of personalities. And over the next decades, more and more and more kids were coming in and more acumen came in. You know, the old saying used to be, never trust a cook with a bank book because, you know, they'll close every business you've ever had. And then acumen started coming into restaurants that hadn't existed. And Alistair was very much the forefront of that. And you know, because he was an archaeologist and educated in Cambridge. And I don't know that he did particularly well. You know, I mean, I got in, everyone went to university. So, you know, I don't think we shone academically, but we were ferociously bright. We're good, keen, interested minds. And I think that was the thing. We were interested and engaged and loved what we did, even for all its cockamamie lifestyle and, you know, the hours that we would have to do and the toll that takes on everything. But generally, it was amazing. And so this acumen in food came in. And so out with the prawn cocktail, thank God, you know, and in with a risotto. And, you know, delicious soups and bright, fresh flavours and delicious ingredients. So that's why I think Simon and Alistair are fundamental to the resurgence and interest in food and cooking in this country.
And then you moved to Blueprint. How did that come about?
Well, there's another restaurant as well. Oh, okay. Well, no, there
we're
was
get our, there.
I know. We'll get there eventually, I promise. We had at Alistair's a young chap come in who was this wild card of an Iranian chap called Marwan Badran, who had won or had done very well on MasterChef, whatever it was at the time, one of these mad television programmes. And he opened this tiny little restaurant in Islington. And I think, like all folk who have not done a great deal of work in restaurants over a long period of time, not quite appreciated quite how much work it was, and thought he could cook in the kitchen and write menus, do it all, and was like, maybe not. It's maybe a bit more involved than you thought. It's, you know, quite a considerable amount, you know, before you even get, you know, like with anything, the fun stuff doesn't even begin. And it is that, and it's the tiniest percentage of the workload of anyone who works in a restaurant or in any workplace, really. And he said, would you come and cook for me, please? So I did, you know, it was an opportunity to be a head chef for the first time. And just couldn't say no. So I sadly and reluctantly left Alistair's to go and do this. But, you know, it was a brilliant opportunity. While there, Terence Conran came to eat, who I'd got to know slightly by cooking at Bibendum, because he obviously owned it and came into the kitchen a lot. And he said, it's you. And I went, oh, yes, oh, it's you. I mean, almost literally took me by the ear and said, you're coming with me, and threw me in the back of a car and said, the blueprint's not working and it's all gone a bit to hell. And would you like it? And there was this very beautiful first floor glass-fronted dining room filled with daylight, overlooking the pool of London, the East Tower Bridge, and these vast East End skies. And I was like, that's nice. I'd like that. And a plain wooden floors, plain white table, Eames furniture, bent wood chairs. I mean, it was beautiful. And really classic old Terence style, solid and sturdy, and these brilliant bistro tables at the back as well. I mean, it was really great. And I was given carte blanche, you know, and so it was, no, really wasn't an option. And it became something I fell madly in love with. And folks said, bloody hell, aren't you ready for something else? I went, like what? And I went, well, like what? You know, and, you know, not that offers didn't come in discussions and conversations we've had over the years, but I have to say, giving up a first floor dining room flooded with light and a kitchen right behind it and carte blanche, you know, no, there was no restrictions at all on the menu. We blessedly liked what we did and what we cooked and the menus we wrote and the produce we bought. You know, when you looked at the small print of other things, you were like, really? You know, and then, you know, and being, you know, this sort of strange thing, this is what Terence had done with Butler's Wharf, was this incredibly central London address that had been so neglected for so long. Matt, you could cook overlooking this water with these great skies on the first floor of the Design Museum, as it was then, right bang in the middle of London. I mean, it was otherworldly. And so it would have to be something quite extraordinary to leave it, you know.
You were there for 18 years.
And 18 years passed. It didn't feel like it. Well, God knows you have your ups and downs. Hell knows, life's not easy, dear. Well, but there was far more fun and satisfaction and pleasure there. And also, it was an extraordinary place where I could hone what I loved and what I was doing, food-wise. That was really extraordinary as well, you know, and without any restrictions whatsoever.
Let's talk about Quo Vadis. What brought you to Quo Vadis? And also, what does Quo Vadis mean to you? It's right in the heart of Soho. It's a London institution.
Golly. Well, I think that the clue's in the name. Whither do you go? And the blueprint was so special. Was, you know, for... It would have to be something really quite extraordinary to, you know, pluck me from that oyster. And along the way, I met, you know, a whole new generation of restaurateurs was coming through. And among them, the genius Sam and Eddie Hart, who had opened Fino just off Charlotte Street, north of Oxford Street, to huge success, cooking Spanish food. And the head chef they had there was this lovely Frenchman called Philippe, Jean-Philippe. But a Frenchman cooking Spanish food actually works incredibly well. A Frenchman cooking British food, not so. And so they opened Quo Vadis to spectacular reviews and success. It was great. And then the world changed. Bang. You know, as always, the carpet ripped from under your feet and the clouds of gloom descend. And, you know, on everyone at the time. It wasn't just them. But no longer were the champagne corks flying and martinis being quaffed by the dozen at lunchtime. And this poor, lovely restaurant slightly calcified. And so Sam and Eddie said, well, would you come and, you know, and I said, God, it's always the bridesmaid, never the bride, isn't it? You know, laughing in the atmosphere, going, oh my God, I can't believe I've just been off at Quo Vadis. That's extraordinary. And I took one look at this benighted old building. And as it is one of the very last of its kind in Soho, and indeed in the West End of London, which is just being squeezed on every level by ruthless rent hikes and shocking mismanagement, actually, I think, and ruthless greed. And you're like, really? You know, because what we're going to end up with, just a great big giant M&M hotel right in the middle of Leicester Square. I mean, that'll be it. And a few shoe shops around it, selling another pair of trainers that you don't need. But there was this amazing opportunity for one of the last great old traditions of Soho. Very, you know, in four old London townhouses, knocked higgledy-piggledy together like some demented gormenghast. You know, and if you ever did meet that countess with the 40 cats, you know, you just run for the hills. And you met a lot of characters in that place, that's for sure. But it was amazing. They gave me carte blanche. Thought we'd take it, you know, as British as can be in a term, because the ruthless reality of Britain is that the seasons are so short and very intense. So bolstered by beautiful produce from elsewhere that we have to import to bolster those moments of want when there isn't so much. And we came up with the menus that we do now. And it was an amazing journey. We did it on Tuppence Halfpenny. And my dear friend, Julian Roberts, took all the scribblings and jottings I'd done and, you know, created this extraordinarily beautiful menu. And John Brodie then come on board as our illustrator. You know, it's an extraordinary family of folk, and Sam and Eddie being, yeah, this is great. You know, I was going, wow, this is an amazing tale. And so it came into being. And we had, then the carpet was pulled out right from under our feet because my father died the very morning we moved in. I mean, really, it's like, Dad, honestly? You know, so I was in a terrible place all over the place. But folk were very kind and supportive, and we managed to get through that terrible time. And then start. And the one good thing about that was because we went a new restaurant, we didn't go into that new restaurant bracket. You know, this was a great old darling. This company just began to call her the great old dame of Dean Street, really. Mm-hmm. Which indeed she is. And there I've been ever since.
And for listeners who might not have been to Quo Vadis, what sort of thing do you cook?
Oh my God. Well, I suppose it is best summed up. Curiously, there is a very lovely, very simple plain menu right in the middle of the cart, and surrounded are a series of little boxes with other little dishes in it. And when we first opened, looking at the boxes, there was a roast and there was a pie. And so, seemingly, in a terse language, because I don't like as you know, the G word, garnishing, you know, flounce. No thanks. But we had one box lying empty. We were going to put a truffle sandwich in there, but sadly, the truffle man did not cometh. And there was a lovely little dish I used to cook at the Blueprint back in the day. There was a little smoked eel sandwich. And I said, oh, just bung that in there, for God's sakes, you know. And brilliantly, we had some of our smoked eel there at the time, so I just bought everything inside because, you know, it was a never-changing, evolving menu. And the smoked eel sandwich became this thing. It struck a chord and became our dish through no plan, no idea. And it is as simple as can be. I mean, it's two little pieces of fried bread, very unctuous, powerful mustard cream, and a very equally unctuous, powerful horseradish cream, great chunks of smoked eel, and a little bit of red onion pickle on the side. And it is that, is all the dish is. But it works, and it sort of sums our food up, that it is very beautiful produce, respected, and put up with just what it needs to eat it and enjoy it with, and no more.
And Clovard is also quite well known for its puddings. I mean, do you like puddings?
Oh. You can blame my grandmother and my father and my mother for that. We had pudding every night when I was growing up. And it's something that I think I hold dear. And I think what's brilliant about them, particularly as well, in these days of everyone's dietary hell that they're all being put through, a very good slice of pudding does you good. You know, and it's only a slice of something, and it's a little spoonful of this and a scoop of that, and, you know, more cream, of course. Yeah. But they're a very good thing, and they've got that, they do just that thing of just a few spoonfuls of naughty and deliciousness, you know, and it's not staring at a packet of biscuits or a never-ending box of chocolates, and, you know, the naughty things puts everyone on a guilt trip.
Do you have a favourite, a desert island pudding? If we gun to your head, one that you have to choose.
You have custard and cream and ice cream.
Almond tart, then. There you go. Oh,
wonderful.
Second by apple pie.
Jeremy, it has been such a joy having you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
A great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories, and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.